I knew you'd come for us one day.
I pull away before she can figure out that I'm not who I said I was.
Of course,
I lie.
We're a family. You must come inside. Grace will be back soon, and we can visit in the meantime.
I'd like that, I say. Serenity and I follow Nevi inside. Not a single window in the house is open, and there is no air circulation. I wonder if I could trouble you for a glass of water, I ask.
No trouble at all, Nevi says.
She leads me into a living room, a big space with a vaulted ceiling and several couches and tables covered with white sheets. One couch has had its protective cover removed. Serenity sits on it while I peek under the sheets, trying to find a desk, a filing cabinet, any sort of information to explain this turn of events.
What the holy hell is happening?
Serenity hisses at me as soon as Nevi shuffles into the kitchen.
Grace will be back soon? I thought she was dead. I thought Nevi was trampled.
I thought that too, I admit. I saw a body, that's for sure.
Was it hers?
But that I can't answer. When I had reached the scene, Gideon was cradling the victim in his lap. I remember the skull split like a melon, the hair shampooed with blood. But I don't know if I ever actually got close enough to see the face. Even if I had, I wouldn't have been able to say it was Nevi Rule, since I'd never even seen a picture of her. I trusted Thomas when he named the victim, because he would have recognized his own employee.
Who called the police that night?
Serenity asks.
Thomas. So maybe he was the one who wanted you to believe Nevi was dead.
But I shake my head.
If Thomas had been the one to go after her in the enclosure, she'd be a lot more nervous than she is right now. And she certainly wouldn't have invited us into her house. Unless she is planning to poison us. Then don't drink the water,
I suggest.
Gideon was the one who found the body. So either he made a mistake, which I don't buy, or he wanted people to think it was Nevi. Well, she didn't just get up from the autopsy table,
Serenity says. I meet her gaze, and I don't have to say anything else. One victim had been taken away that night in a body bag. One victim had been found unconscious, with a blow to the head that maybe could even have resulted in latent blindness, and had been taken to the hospital. Just then, Nevi comes into the room, carrying a tray with a pitcher of water and two glasses. Let me help, I say, taking them from her hands and setting them down on top of a covered coffee table. I pick up the pitcher and pour a glass for each of us. There is a clock somewhere. I can hear the ticking, even if I cannot see it. It's probably rotting away underneath one of the sheets. It's like the whole room is filled with the ghosts of former furniture. How long have you lived here? I ask her.
I've lost track now. Grace was the one who took care of me, you know, after the accident. I don't know what I would have done without her.
Accident?
You know, that night at the sanctuary, the one where I lost my sight. I suppose after hitting my head like that, it could have been much worse. I'm lucky, or so they say.
She sinks down, oblivious to the sheet that covers the wing chair.
I don't remember any of it, which is probably a blessing. When Grace gets here, she can explain everything.
She glances in my direction.
I never blamed you or Mara, Thomas. I hope you know that. Who's Mara?
Serenity pipes up. Until this moment, she hasn't spoken in Nevi's presence. Nevi turns, a hesitant smile playing over her lips.
How rude of me. I didn't realize you brought a guest.
I look at Serenity, panicked. I have to introduce her in a way that follows the fiction I've created, where I am impersonating Thomas Metcalf.
No, I'm the one who's been rude, I say. Do you remember my wife, Alice?
The glass slides out of Nevi's hand, shattering on the floor. I kneel to mop up the water, using one of the sheets covering the furniture. But I am not mopping fast enough. The water soaks through the sheet, and the puddle widens. The knees of my jeans are drenched, and the spill has swelled into a pool. It covers Nevi's feet in her mismatched shoes. Serenity cranes her neck to look around the room.
Sweet Jesus!
The wallpaper is weeping. Water trickles from the ceiling. I glance at Nevi and find her leaning back in her chair, her hands gripping the armrests, her face wet with her own tears and the sobs of this house. I can't move. I can't explain what the hell is happening. Overhead, I watch a crack form in the center of the ceiling and spread as if it is only a matter of time before the plaster gives way. Serenity grabs my arm.
Run!
She shouts, and I follow her out of the house. My shoes splash in puddles that have pooled on the hardwood floors. We don't stop until we are back at the curb, panting.
I think I lost my goddamn weave,
Serenity says, patting the back of her head. Her pink hair, soaked, makes me think of the bloody skull of the victim at the elephant sanctuary. I lean down, still gasping for air. The house on the hill looks just as ramshackle and uninviting as it did when we first arrived. The only evidence of our visit is the damp, frantic trail of footprints on the path, tracks that are rapidly vanishing in the heat, as if we were never there at all.
Alice. 2 months is a long time to be gone. A lot can happen in 2 months. I didn't know where Thomas was, and I wasn't sure I wanted to find out. I didn't know if he was coming back, but he hadn't just left Jenna and me. He had left 7 elephants and a sanctuary staff, which meant that someone needed to take over the business. In 2 months, you can start to feel confident again. In 2 months, you might discover that, in addition to being a scientist, you are also a very good businesswoman. In 2 months, a child can start talking up a storm, cobbled sentences and twisted syllables, naming the world that looks just as new to her as it does to you. In 2 months, you can start over. Gideon had become my right-hand man. Although we talked about hiring a new employee, we didn't have the money for it. We could do this, he assured me. If I could balance my research with the more cerebral, financial work, he could be the brawn. Because of this, he was often working an 18-hour day. One evening, after dinner, I picked up Jenna and wandered out to the point on the property where he was trying to mend a fence. I reached for a pair of pliers and went to work beside him.
You don't have to do that, he told me.
Neither do you, I said. It became a routine. After 6 o'clock, we would work in tandem at whatever was still left on the endless to-do list. We took Jenna with us, and she would collect flowers and chase the wild rabbits that ran through the tall grass. Somehow, we fell into that habit. Somehow, we fell. Mora and Hester were together again in the African enclosure. They had begun to bond and were rarely seen apart. Mora was definitely in charge. When she challenged Hester, the younger elephant would turn around, presenting her bottom, a sign of subordinance. I had witnessed Mora returning to the gravesite of her calf only once since our evening in the swimming pond. She had managed to compartmentalize her grief, to move on. I took Jenna with me every day to observe the elephants, even though I knew Thomas thought it was dangerous. He was not here. He no longer got a vote. My toddler was a natural scientist. She would move around the enclosures, collecting rocks and grasses and wildflowers, and would sort them into piles. Most of these afternoons, Gideon found some work in our vicinity so that he could sit down and rest with us for a little while. I started to bring an extra snack for him, more iced tea. Gideon and I talked about Botswana, about the elephants I had known there, and how they were so different from the animals here. We talked about the stories he'd heard from the keepers who traveled with the elephants when they arrived at the sanctuary, of animals being beaten or stuffed into a chute while being trained.
One day, he was telling me about Lily, the elephant whose leg had never set properly after breaking.
She was in a different circus before that, Gideon said. The ship she was traveling on was docked in Nova Scotia when it caught on fire. It sank. Some of the animals on it were killed. Lily made it out alive, but with second-degree burns on her back and her legs.
Lily, who I'd been taking care of now for nearly 2 years, had been hurt even more than I'd imagined. "It's amazing," I said, "how they don't blame us for what other people did to them."
"I think they forgive."
Gideon looked at Mora, his mouth turning down at the corners.
"I hope they forgive. Do you think she remembers me taking the baby away?"
"Yes," I said bluntly. "But she doesn't hold it against you anymore." Gideon looked like he was about to respond, but suddenly his face froze, and he leaped up and started running. Jenna, who knew better than to stray close to the elephants, who had never tested her limits before, was standing 2 feet away from Mora, staring up at her in a trance. She looked at me, smiling.
"Elephant," she announced.
Mora reached out her trunk, huffing over Jenna's very fine pigtails. It was a moment of magic and of supreme danger. Children and elephants are unpredictable. One sudden move and Jenna could have been trampled. I rose, my mouth dry. Gideon was already there, moving slowly so as not to startle Mora into action. He scooped Jenna into his arms as if this were a game.
"Let's get you back to your mama," he said,
and he looked over his shoulder at Mora. That's when Jenna started to scream.
"Elephant," she yelled. "I want."
She kicked against Gideon's abdomen and squirmed like a fish on the line. It was a full-blown tantrum. The noise startled Mora, who bolted into the woods, trumpeting.
"Jenna," I snapped. "You don't go near the animals. You know better than that."
But the fear in my voice only made her cry harder. Gideon grunted as one of her little sneakers connected with his groin.
"I'm so sorry," I said, reaching for her. But Gideon turned away.
He kept rocking Jenna, bouncing her in his arms, until her screams thinned and her sobs became hiccups. She grabbed the collar of his red uniform shirt in her fist and started to rub the corner of it against her cheek, the way she did with her blanket when she was falling asleep. A few minutes later, he laid my dozing child down at my feet. Jenna's cheeks were flushed, her lips parted. I crouched beside her. She might have been made of porcelain, of moonlight.
"She was overtired," I said.
"She was terrified," Gideon corrected, sitting down beside me again. "After the fact."
"Well," I looked up at him. "Thank you." He stared off into the trees where Mora had vanished.
"Did she run off?"
I nodded. "She was terrified after the fact, too," I said. "Do you know that in all the years I've been doing research, I've never seen an elephant mother lose her temper with a baby? No matter how annoying or whiny or difficult the baby's being?" I reached out to pull a ribbon out of Jenna's hair, which was trailing like an afterthought in the wake of her outburst. Unfortunately, I don't seem to have the same skill set in my parenting.
"Jenna's lucky to have you,"
I smirked. "Considering I'm all she's got."
"No," Gideon said. "I watch you when you're with her. You're a good mother."
I shrugged, waiting for the self-deprecating joke to come, but the words, the validation, meant too much to me. Instead, I heard myself say, "You'd be a good father, too."
He picked up one of the dandelions Jenna had yanked out of the ground and stockpiled before she wandered over toward Mora. He carved a slit in its stem with his thumb and threaded a second through the first.
I sort of thought I would be one by now.
I pressed my lips together because Grace's secret wasn't mine to give. Gideon continued to string the weeds together.
Do you ever wonder if you fall for a person? Or just the idea of her?
What I think is that there is no perspective in grief or in love. How can there be? When one person becomes the center of the universe, either because he has been lost or because he has been found. Gideon took the crown of daisies and slipped it over Jenna's head. It tipped sideways on the knob of one pigtail, falling over her brow. In her sleep, she stirred. Sometimes I think there's no such thing as falling in love. It's just the fear of losing someone. There was a breeze, carrying the scent of wild apples and timothy grass, the earthy smell of elephant hide and manure, the juice of the peach that Jenna had eaten earlier and that had dripped onto her sundress.
Do you worry?
Gideon asked.
About what will happen if he doesn't come back?
It was the first time, really, that we had talked about Thomas leaving. Although we had shared stories of how we met our spouses, that was where the conversation had stayed, at the highest peak of potential, at the moment in those relationships when everything still seemed possible. Lifting my chin, I looked squarely at Gideon. I worry about what will happen if he does, I said. It was colic. It was not uncommon in elephants, especially ones who had been given bad hay or whose diet had been radically and quickly changed. Neither of those was the case for Sira, but still she lay on her side, drowsy, bloated. She wouldn't eat or drink. Her stomach growled. Gertie, the dog who was her constant companion, sat at her side and howled. Grace was at my cottage babysitting for Jenna. She'd stay there all night so that we could watch over the elephant. Gideon had volunteered, but I was in charge now. There was no way I couldn't be there too. We stood in the barn with our arms crossed, watching the vet examine the elephant.
He's just going to tell us what we already know,
Gideon whispered to me. Yeah, and then he's going to give her drugs to make her better. He shook his head.
What do you plan to pawn to pay his bill?
Gideon was right about that. Money was so tight right now that we had to borrow from our operating expenses if we were going to cover the cost of emergencies like this one. I'll figure it out, I said, scowling. We watched the vet give Sira an anti-inflammatory, Flunixin, and a muscle relaxant. Gertie curled up beside her in the hay, whimpering.
All we can really do is wait and hope she starts passing boluses, he said. In the meantime, get her to drink some water.
But Sira didn't want to drink. Every time we came near her with a bucket, whether it was heated or cooled, she huffed and tried to turn her head away. After several hours of this, Gideon and I were both emotionally wrecked. Whatever the vet had administered did not seem to be working. It is a pitiful thing seeing such a strong and majestic animal laid low. It made me think of the elephants in the bush I'd seen who had been shot by villagers or injured by snares. I knew, too, that colic wasn't something to be taken lightly. It could lead to impaction, and that could lead to death. I knelt beside Sira, palpating her, feeling the tightness of her abdomen. Has this happened before?
Not to Sira, he said. But it's not the first time I've seen it.
He seemed to be chewing on a thought, equivocating. Then he looked at me.
Do you use baby oil on Jenna's skin.
I used to put it in the bath, I said. Why?
Where is it?
If I still have any, it would be under the sink in the bathroom.
He stood up and walked out of the barn.
Where are you going?
I called, but I couldn't follow him. I wouldn't leave Sierra.
10 minutes later, Gideon returned. He was holding 2 bottles of baby oil and a Sara Lee pound cake I recognized from my own refrigerator. I followed him into the kitchen of the Asian barn, where we prepared meals for the elephants. He started to unwrap the cake's packaging. I'm not hungry, I told him.
This isn't for you.
Gideon set the cake on the counter and began to stab it with a knife, repeatedly. I think it's dead, I said. He opened a bottle of baby oil and poured it over the cake. The fluid began to sink into the sponge, settling into the puncture marks he'd made.
At the circus, the elephants colicked sometimes. The vet used to tell us to get them to drink oil. I guess it gets things moving.
The vet didn't say,
Alice.
Gideon hesitated, his hands stilling over the cake.
Do you trust me?
I looked at this man, who had worked by my side for weeks now to create the illusion that this sanctuary could survive, who had saved me once, and my daughter. I read once, in a silly women's magazine at the dentist, that when we like someone, our pupils dilate, and that we tend to like people whose pupils are dilated when they look at us. It's an endless cycle. We want the people who want us. Gideon's irises were nearly the same color as his pupils, which created an optical illusion, a black hole, an endless fall. I wondered what mine looked like in response. Yes, I said. He instructed me to get a bucket of water, and I followed him into the stall where Sierra still lay on her side, her belly rising and falling with effort. Gertie sat up, suddenly alert.
Hey, beautiful,
Gideon said, kneeling in front of the elephant. He held out the cake.
Sierra, she's got a real sweet tooth, he told me.
She sniffed the cake with her trunk. She touched it gingerly. Gideon broke off a small piece and tossed it into Sierra's mouth while Gertie sniffed at his fingers. A moment later, Sierra took the entire cake and swallowed it whole.
Water,
Gideon said. I settled the bucket where Sierra could reach and watched her siphon out a trunkful. Gideon leaned in, his strong hands stroking her flank, telling her what a good girl she was. I wished he would touch me like that. The thought came so fast that I fell back on my heels. I have to go check on Jenna, I stammered. Gideon glanced up.
I'm sure she and Grace are both asleep.
I have to... My voice trailed off. My face was hot. I pressed my palms against my cheeks. Turning, I hurried out of the barn. Gideon was right. When I reached the cottage, Grace and Jenna were curled together on the couch. Jenna's hand was caught in Grace's. It made me feel sick to know that while Grace had been taking care of someone I loved, I had been wishing I could do the same with someone she loved. She stirred, careful to sit up without waking Jenna. Is it Sierra? What happened? I gathered Jenna into my arms. She woke up briefly before her eyes drifted shut again. I didn't want to disturb her, but it was more important in that moment to remember who I was, what I was, a mother, a wife. You should tell him, I said to Grace, about not being able to have a baby. She narrowed her eyes. We had not discussed this since first broaching the topic weeks ago. I knew she was worried that maybe I had already said something to Gideon, but that wasn't it at all. I wanted them to have that conversation so Gideon would know Grace trusted him wholly. I wanted them to have that conversation so they could make plans for a future that included surrogacy or adoption. I wanted the bond between them to be so strong that I could not, even accidentally, find a chink in the wall of their marriage through which I could peek. You should tell him, I repeated, because he deserves to know. The next morning, two wonderful things happened. Sierra got up, seemingly over her colic, and wandered with a bouncing Gertie into the Asian enclosure. And the fire department dropped off a gift, a used fire hose that they wanted to donate since they'd recently upgraded their equipment. Gideon, who had gotten even less sleep than I had, seemed to be in a terrific mood. If Grace had taken my advice and spoken to him about her secret, he either had taken it well or was too happy about Sierra's recovery to let the news affect him. At any rate, he certainly didn't seem to be thinking twice about my awkward exit the night before. He hefted the hose over his shoulder